Welcome back. Those of you who made it. I guess all of you made it. Except some of you didn't go anywhere. Some of you stayed here. As I did. How many of you who stayed here expected to get a lot of work done? As I did. How many of you actually did get a lot of work done? One, two. Make me feel bad. I actually got a lot of work done. I just didn't do the things that I thought I was going to get done, and therefore, it feels like I didn't get things done. But when I become a grown-up, I will be organized, and I will have everything done, have my life in order, and as soon as I become a grown-up, right? Did we decide you weren't doing a makeup Wednesday after class? Okay. Wednesday after class, if you need to retake the eco exam, it'll be here after class on Wednesday. If you can't make that, email us. After Friday, the number of points you can possibly get goes down again. So get it done this week. Study it. Do it. Get it done, get it out of the way, get maximum points. Nicole.
Are you given retakes for people that miss?
Yes. If, yeah. For anybody who needs to take it, either take it or retake it. You ask Julie because she has the roster after class. Okay. Remember Bronfenbrenner? Duvel Ecology? Anybody have good examples from wherever you went? Home, perhaps? No? That's okay. We won't ask Julie to talk about family. See anybody developing while you were away? Experience a change in setting, ecological transition. How many of you took on a new role last week? Wet t-shirt contestant. Drunken college student in Fort Lauderdale. Housing rehabilitator in Mississippi. Cleanup crew in New Orleans. How many of you went south? Mississippi, New Orleans, the Gulf, Katrina. How many of you did something that was worthwhile and useful to other people? For other people. Good. Okay. So did you take on new roles? Old role? New molar activities for anybody? Yeah? New relationships that you can tell your parents about? Okay. Did any of you feel that the change in scenery, new settings that you added to your ecosystem, new activities that you engaged in, new relationships that you created, will somehow be helpful to your own development? Wasted week, huh? You're not raising your hand because you hadn't thought about it yet, and because you're afraid I'll call on you if you do. I promise I won't. How many of you think that developmentally what you did in the last 10 days might be good for your development? Yes! All right. And can you explain why developmentally, in terms of reciprocity and new molar activities, different view of the world, new skills? Again, I won't call on you. Okay, so you can explain it? Okay. Part of the usefulness of the developmental perspective is that it gives you a set of concepts, as you've explored in exercise 4, which you will get back someday. They Julie went away all of last week, so they're not finished yet. Because she wasn't here to remind me every day to finish them up. So I didn't, but I will. I promise. So you explored that in that exercise, and now you have last week that some of you can apply a developmental perspective to. So now I'm going to jump back to where we left off and talk about how we might apply a developmental perspective to relationships and creating relationships, and pick up where we left off. If you will recall, looking at your notes or on the web, we had tackled the questions of what is love, what kind of romantic dyadic relationship you would like to have, and common problems. And the fun thing I was doing at the end of class, the latter part of class last week ago Wednesday, was trying to apply a developmental perspective to the relationship problems that you brought up in class. We weren't done with that, but we talked about jealousy, we talked about conflict, and several other of the issues, sitting around like a bump on a log, becoming a couch potato because you were in the relationship and therefore no longer had to work on it, those sorts of things. So I wanted to pick up there and see if there were other burning issues, problems in relationships that you experience or that people you know experience that you wanted to bring up, or did you think about them and come up with examples over the last few days?
My boyfriend went to Jamaica, and he saw a bunch of interesting things go on in Jamaica, including what t-shirt contest, and proceeded to come back and ask me if I'd ever cheated throughout their relationship, and he got really angry about it, even though it's never happened.
He got really angry about the fact that you haven't?
No, just constantly, continuously being like, have you cheated? And she was like, no. Because
You weren't being honest.
Yeah.
Because you weren't telling him that you had.
Yeah, well, I was being really honest.
Right.
But he said after seeing all the girls down in Jamaica doing that kind of stuff, it made him question that kind of thing, because he said a lot of them had boyfriends.
Yeah. So when are you going to dump this turkey?
I don't know.
Now, don't tell him I call him a turkey, please. How big is he? Okay. Yeah. And we'll spot him about 20 years or 40 years too. Okay. But don't tell him I called him a turkey. But what you saw was the jealousy and the suspicion, and we all suspect that it was fueled by his desire to know that since he had cheated in Jamaica that you had too at some point, that would make his being okay. I mean, just going to a wet t-shirt contest and enjoying it was cheating, right?
I was not happy.
You were not happy. That's good. Okay. So those of you who were in Jamaica participating in the wet t-shirt contest, you contributed to relationship conflict. I'm sorry? Sure. I do remember what a skin bar is. Having been warned not to go into them.
I don't think I would be sure if they would send it to my girlfriend when they wanted, to put dollar bills down in the pants. That guy didn't make her back off, but then later on, I think I'd be okay with this. If you guys hit me in front of
Kim? None of you mind if your partner goes to a strip club without you? Right.
I might say if they didn't know about it.
How many of you have partners who mind that you go? So if you're going to a strip club, you A, ought to make it a joint activity. with your partner, right? So you do it together, and then while you're, before you go, you discuss exploitation and objectification and the sociological implications of strip clubs and the selling of sexuality. And then while you're there, you review those things together so that you don't enjoy the performances. And then afterward, you discuss it and this is the way it happens. Right? I'm reflecting a wonderful experience I had a number of years ago when I was at a conference in Amsterdam. And several things happened during that 10 days of first-class treatment in Amsterdam. One of which was that a wonderful sociologist from The Hague, who is an expert on the, I've forgotten what he called it, the that part of our culture which makes its money from other people's vices. He was an expert on gambling, prostitution, sexuality, things of selling sexuality, those sorts of things. So he gave a small group of us a personal guided tour of the red light district in Amsterdam. It was just fascinating discussion of the rules and regulations, the economy. It was very interesting way to visit the red light district, and it only cost me a little bit of money because he had a number of favorite bars and establishments, and we stopped in a number of them and had beer, and I had to stand a couple of rounds with the group. But it was an interesting way to get to know that part of Amsterdam. And one of the follow-ups was that a couple of days later, I was walking from one meeting to another and walked through one of the areas that he had taken us through and discovered that during the day it was a family neighborhood, and it was an area where we had been propositioned as a group and as individuals by prostitutes. And in explaining the culture, part of the discussion that he had led us through was that many of the women there were married, many of them. It was a very stable kind of job. It was very well regulated. And during the day in the same neighborhood, I saw mothers with their children in the neighborhood, and looked like a sort of normal neighborhood. Enough said about that trip. I won't do any more. You had a question?
Oh, no. Yeah.
Okay. It'll come back. Okay. Other issues in relationships that you wanted to throw out for discussion? The observation is that at home she discovered that friends of her parents were divorcing, in part because her suspicion had been that he was having an affair and had hired a detective and caught him first weekend. Must have wanted to be caught. So that was really weird because it changed their role and their relationship with you. Which part of it shall we subject to develop ecological analysis? Affairs? affairs are fun, but I'm going to do that a little bit later. Because you can, very nicely. I'd like to do them in the context of marriage and divorce rather than in the dating part. But cheating is clearly a violation of the expectations of the role of partner. And when there's a commitment to that partner role, it tends to make the cheated on partner pissed off. And it can get you killed. And in some cultures, killing your partner who's cheated is justifiable homicide. You're not going to get prosecuted for it. In our culture, we tend to frown on it, preferring the divorce route than homicide. Question? Yeah. Yeah. The example is people who stayed together, probably to raise kids, seeing that as an important joint activity, which it is. And then as soon as the nest emptied out, everybody left. The couple went separate ways. We'll talk about the empty nest divorce and whether staying together for the sake of the children is a reasonable thing to do. And the answer to that depends on how much conflict there is within the home. If the kids don't know and there's no conflict and people can put up a good front and they're happy doing that, then it's not terribly detrimental to kids' development. They just go off to college and then feel like their parents have abandoned them by getting married and lying to them all these years. Some of you have been through that. On the other hand, if there's a lot of conflict in the parental relationship, that's more damaging to kids' development. More developmentally risky to be in a microsystem that includes a lot of conflict and negative affect, because you learn things that aren't going to do you well in future relationships. Yes? Okay. The observation is that in some cultures, and particularly the Jamaican workers in the Cayman Islands, young men often had multiple children by multiple partners and continued to have multiple partners, while the expectation was that the partners were all monogamous. So it's a double standard in the culture, and they didn't see it as anything wrong. And they would have assumed it was a double standard and that was appropriate. And that is a nice illustration of a macro system difference, because the expectations for relationships for you, I assume, are a little bit different. How many of you expect your male partners to have a number of partners with whom they have children? Macro system difference. You don't expect that. And you wouldn't put up with it. And you believe that that's not good for you. Okay. So you have a consistency across a whole bunch of you within this culture and a belief that underlies that set of consistencies, the common belief that both partners should be monogamous. And if you're going to have children, you certainly should be monogamous. That's fairly strongly held in our culture. It's not always adhered to, but it's a held belief. But in other cultures, there is a clear double standard. and they don't see anything wrong with that. They believe that that's appropriate. So that's a macro system difference. Okay. Others? Okay, let me move on then. And where do we want to go? I want to talk briefly about one of the readings. That's interesting. I am going to talk about one of the readings. I just have to find the overheads for it. Okay. We've been talking about problems. I want to talk a little more about a good relationship and just remind you that you have a relationship, I mean a reading. You have a relationship with the reading by Pepper Schwartz on love is not all you need. And in this article, it's a very brief article, it's kind of fun, Pepper Schwartz describes the responses of couples who describe themselves as happy in their relationship, comparing that to couples who describe themselves as being unhappy. And in looking at the questionnaire responses that the two kinds of couples gave, these were out of the 100 or so items on the inventory that she administered, the top group is the one that the happy and unhappy couples disagreed significantly on. And on these, the happy couples feel that my partner's a good listener, we have a good balance of leisure time spent together and separately, we find it easy to think of things to do together, I'm very satisfied with how we talk to each other, we are creative in how we handle our differences, making financial decisions is not difficult. Our sexual relationship is satisfying and fulfilling. We're both equally willing to make adjustments in the relationship. I can share feelings and ideas with my partner during disagreements. And my partner understands my opinions and ideas. Happy couples describe themselves that way, describe themselves and their partners that way. The unhappy couples don't. Okay, so the unhappy couples disagree with all of those. And then the one on which the unhappy couples all agree is that my partner does not understand how I feel. Okay. So if you want to think about your own relationships now and in the future or past, you could ask yourself the same questions. Did we agree on these areas of our relationship, or did we not? Think about each of those. My partner is a very good listener. What I'd like you to think about is the characteristics of relations. Reciprocity, affect, and power. And some of the characteristics that might be beneficial to development, such as engagement in joint activities that the couple both enjoy. Activities have become more complex. I see some of you squinting, so maybe I'll lower the lights and increase the brights. Is that better? Poetry is in my soul. Now you can see. But you also have read the reading and taken notes on it, so you already know all these things. So your partner is a good listener. Where does that fall? Reciprocity. You can exchange those roles. He's a good listener. She's a good listener. I'm a good listener, we hope. We have a good balance of leisure time spent together and separately. Joint activities, but not smothering. What do you suppose they do when they're not together? They cheat on each other. No, they engage in other activities that are important to them, and they probably go into settings that are not settings that they're both engaged in. So they have a more complex mesosystem, and they do that separately. They allow each other to be engaged in settings and perhaps activities and relationships that are not shared. So they appreciate each other's autonomy in doing that. And for most of us, what happens when our partners are engaged in things that we're not engaged in is that then we can talk about those and it makes the relationship more complex and more interesting. We find it easy to think of things to do together. So they like some of the same things. And they have a repertoire of things to do together, which might suggest that their repertoire of molar activities is fairly diverse and they're structurally different. So if you think about the molar activities becoming more diverse and more differentiated, more complex, then these are people who are probably at roughly the same level of development, and they can think of things to do, so they're probably both fairly substantially well developed. They can do things on their own, and they can think of things to do as a couple. I'm very satisfied with how we talk to each other. Communication skills. Probably a balance of power. It's easier to talk to somebody who is considering you as an equal and to do that reciprocally. They're creative in how we handle our differences, so they recognize difference and they're able to engage in resolving differences. And creativity in resolving differences and handling them might suggest, again, that they have a fairly complex view of the world. They're not simple-minded. Simple-minded people who don't have much in the way of differentiated understanding of the world are much better able to resolve differences in satisfying ways. Making financial decisions is not difficult. Money is a major hassle in many relationships. And in this case, it isn't. We don't know why. It may be because one of them makes all the decisions. And that's fine, but they agree on it. Sexual relationship is satisfying and fulfilling. Both equally willing to make adjustments in the relationship, which means they're focusing on the transaction between them and perhaps a valid view of the role of being partner, and flexible, they're flexible in the ways that they can be partners. So the role, they may interpret the roles in ways that make it easier for them to change. I can share feelings and ideas with my partner during disagreements, and that last phrase, during disagreements, is a very critical piece of that. Because it's much harder to share feelings and thoughts with somebody when you are having a disagreement. But doing so is essential. Being able to do so is essential to resolving disagreement. We'll talk about that in a bit. My partner understands my opinions and ideas. My partner has a valid view of the world, including me, and is interested. It takes being in the relationship and being my partner as an important activity. And contrast that with my partner does not understand how I feel. So you have two people who don't have reciprocal understanding of each other. And to be in a relationship where you feel like the other person doesn't understand you makes one feel typically unloved, unrespected, and unimportant. If your partner is not able to expend the energy to try to figure out, not by reading your mind, but by asking you questions and listening and studying you, if your partner is unwilling to do that or unable to do that, it makes you feel like you're not as important as the transmission in the car, which he probably is interested in understanding, or the cake recipe, which she is interested in understanding more than she's interested in understanding you. Okay, that sets the stage for thinking about communication. And I want to think about communication and argument, since communication seems to be important, and being able to argue in ways that don't destroy the relationship seems to be important. And think about it, starting with the transactional assumption that in a relationship there are two people, each of whom is in charge of his or her own behavior, and what they create together is a relationship which is neither of them, but is the transaction between them. When couples get into argument regularly, one of the reasons for that, typically, is that they're trying to get the other person to change his or her behavior or his or her understanding of the world. So you start with some differing viewpoint about how things are or how things should be, and you make those known to your differing viewpoint known to the other person, and then you end up trying to change the other person so that you can come to agreement. The transactional assumption encourages people to stop blaming and trying to change the other person and focus on changing the transaction that's going on between you. Especially if you get into the same argument over and over again, or if your arguments tend to escalate and are threatening to the relationship. So if you focus then on yourself, and try to modify the way you engage in the transaction, you have the potential to change the transaction in ways that might help the other person. You're also, at the same time, if you have a valid view of the world, you're attending to the relationship, so that you're focusing on how the other person is responding in it. Now that means that, unlike the unhappy couples, you have to try to understand your partner. What is it that's going on for my partner when we're having this kind of argument? What is my partner's view of the world? What is my partner's perspective? How does my partner see what's going on? That means you might have to ask questions rather than try to read minds. But if you're focused on blaming the other person or convincing the other person to see the world your way, that stops you from understanding the other person. If you focus on understanding each of you and then try to understand the transaction that you're involved in, then you're at the beginning of changing the argument into a discussion, changing the conflict into understanding. You may come to the point of agreeing to disagree, to have different views of the world, but at least you'll know that's what you're doing rather than calling each other names or being angry. Nicole?
I feel like a lot of women that I've known in my life that have done abusive relationship deepest stance, and they try to focus on themselves and try to modify their behavior in order to get the other person to respond well. Or even if it's not a physically abusive relationship, even if like emotionally or mentally abusive relationship, I've seen so many women that I know try to take this kind of, you know, look or viewpoint mm-hmm. on it and behave that way in relationships, and I feel like it doesn't help the relationship. I know it's not going to change the other person because that's not what you're trying to do, but it doesn't ever help the relationship either.
Okay, I'll disagree with the conclusion, but I'll agree with the beginning part, and then I'll tell you why I disagree with the conclusion. The observation is that often women, and I'm going to say a lot of men, in relationships where there's conflict, take the passive role of trying to be what the partner wants. And that's not the way you said it, so I'll say it the way you said it, and then I'll revise it. That people try to understand the partner and try to focus on themselves and change their behavior in ways that will improve the transaction, but it doesn't help. The other person doesn't, in fact, change, doesn't become a better person. And it is true that people will attempt to change themselves to be what the other person wants. That's not what this says. What this says is try to understand what the other person wants so you can decide whether you want to do it his or her way, to understand that position, and to be able to articulate your position, which may or may not be different. Making your position clear to the partner in a way that doesn't blame the partner is a first step in helping the partner understand what he or she needs to do in order to change the transaction. If you don't make yourself known as a respect-worthy human being in a relationship, the other person has to read your mind. And mind reading is not a very common human skill. But many of us expect our partners to read our minds. You know, if you loved me, you would understand me. That's bullshit. You know, if you're a mind reader, you'll understand me, but if I love you and I'm interested in you loving me, I will tell you how I feel. And in a happy relationship, as Pepper Schwartz documented, couples feel that they are able to talk about their feelings and have them heard. So what happens in abusive relationships or arguments that aren't going anywhere is that people don't listen to each other. And you can put your perspective out there and say, this is what I need, this is what I would like from you. And if the other person doesn't respond to that, then the conflict is not going to get resolved. So we have to assume at the beginning that the other person wants to have a relationship with you. And it helps to know that you can always leave the relationship. There is no reason to stay in a relationship that is abusive. So you can set those limits. And you can do that very clearly at the beginning of a relationship and follow through on it. And the limit that I suggest is you can threaten me once, don't ever do it again. You can hit me once, and the relationship is over. Push me, threaten me, hit me, hurt me. I don't deserve that. You don't have the right to do it. I'm out of here. And then if you get hit, leave. If you get threatened, leave. Get a restraining order, leave. Take the kids, whatever it takes. You do not have any responsibility to stay with somebody who does not treat you appropriately. From the beginning of your dating relationship to 30 years into your marriage. Boy, that sounded strong, didn't it? Yes.
Why are you like this? You know, and I'm always waiting for it, but I found myself totally
was like, cool, leave me alone. You know, I was like, all right, peace out. And then he just stopped doing it. You know, because that's not the response he wanted. He wanted me to argue, but he knew I wasn't going to. He stopped trying. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I guess that's more of the, I guess an example of stop trying to change, try to change yourself or what you're doing in order to change them. It's hard, though. It's really, really hard to walk away.
Mm-hmm.
It works.
There are many ways to walk away, too. And it's very important to walk away from relationships, at least temporarily, to be able to do that. It's also very important to be able to walk away from relationships permanently. And that's very, very difficult for most of us, to walk away from a relationship that we put time and effort into, and not keep going back and going back and going back and going back and trying to, you know, it'll be better. You know, if I'm just a better person, I'll make it better. But you don't have to do that. And it's very important to know when a relationship is over and when it's not going to work. And just be very clear about that. And follow through. But that requires that you have a valid view of yourself and that you have the personal commitment to taking care of yourself. And that you have the skills to do that. And there are lots of important ways to do that. One is to prove that you can do that before you make a commitment in a relationship. So my first wife will tell you, I'm commissioned by her to tell every class, this is Kit Cullinan's advice to all of you, never make a commitment in a relationship and live with somebody until you have proven that you can live on your own and take care of yourself and get to the library and do all of those other things without somebody else taking care of you. Dealing with landlords, dealing with your car, paying your rent, getting a job, supporting yourself, taking care of the creditors. All of those things, cooking for yourself, feeding yourself, doing your laundry, cleaning your house. All of those things, my first wife will tell you, you should learn to do before you get married. Before you cohabit with somebody. Before you make a commitment to somebody who is going to keep you from learning those things. And if you don't learn them, then you're dependent on the other person. And then you can't walk out. Then you're not free to leave. You also want a partner who is able to do those things so that you're able to leave and not be guilt-tripped into, how will I eat if you don't feed me? How will I pay my bills if you don't pay my bills? If both partners know that they're grown-ups and they can do those things for themselves, then they can focus on a relationship that is not based on taking care of each other's unmet needs, except the important unmet needs of sex, love, support, emotional support, growing together, raising children, all of those wonderful things that people might want to do together, that aren't focused on taking care of the things that the other person doesn't know how to do because he or she's never learned to do them. So, okay, Kit, I told him. She appreciates that.
I was going to say, I have a really random example of what she said about that. I had to change the headlight in my car. No idea how to do it. My boyfriend's like, don't do it, I'll do it for you. And I was like, no.
Right.
I'm going to figure out how to do it myself. And I got it.
Right.
All on
yes.
myself. No
yes.
idea what to do. I got
yes.
it.
Yes. I got my first computer many years ago, and my son said, I'll set it up for you, Dad. I said, no, you won't. Thanks very much. I appreciate the offer. I would like you to stand by the phone in case I need technical advice, but I really need to learn to do this myself. I need to do it on my own so I don't have to call you every time something goes wrong. I know some of the basics. I once read a wonderful article by a university president who was also a philosopher by trade, and he wrote an article once about how he had come in his 50s to discover that there were lots of things in the world he didn't think he could do that he had discovered he could do. And he came to this wonderful realization that he was a competent human being while crossing a desert by automobile. I think he was in Nevada, but anyway, he was way far away from anywhere. And his car accelerator stopped functioning. And he didn't know how to make it work. And so this was pre-cell phone days. pre-Telstar days. So he was going to sit there until he died of dehydration or something on this not very well-traveled road. And he said what he did that really surprised him was that he decided to look at the accelerator. So he opened the door and he got down where he could look at the accelerator in the car, and he wiggled it around a little bit, and he realized that somehow that pedal is attached to something that comes through the front wall of the car. And it didn't seem to be attached, which is why it wasn't working. And so he looked at it even more carefully. So this took about 15 minutes, and he ended up figuring out by looking at it eventually how to put it back together and reattach it. And this was the first time in his life that he had ever done anything on a car. And he didn't talk about it increasing his masculinity or his sense of self or anything. He just said it was a big relief to him to discover that if you look at something long enough and think about it, rather than panicking or getting on the cell phone, which he didn't have, you might actually be able to figure these things out. And it was very important for him to have done that. And his advice was, you know, a lot of us call for help before we look at something. And changing a headlight, it's very self-satisfying to be able to take care of yourself. And it helps you have confidence that you don't need to rely on somebody else for everything. There's some things you need to rely on people for, and that's okay. But to rely on other people to take care of your basic needs in such a way that you can't live without them and therefore have to submit yourself to whatever abuse they visit on you, that's not good. And staying in a lousy relationship and, as we call it, again, submerging yourself or giving up yourself in order to keep the other person reasonably happy is not a nice way to go through life. It's also not a good way to have a good relationship. It's not the kind of loving, romantic relationship you want. So, in order to have the kind of relationship you want, you have to become a grown-up. Not today, but eventually you have to become a grown-up so that both people are grown-ups, so that they're both free to assert themselves in the relationship responsibly and be prepared to leave if over time it doesn't work. If you're being abused, you don't deserve to be abused. No matter what the other person says, you don't deserve to be abused. You're a human being. So don't do it. The problem for many of us is that we're in abusive relationships and don't understand even that we are. We do dumb things like make excuses for the other person. We accept the other's excuses. Well, he was drunk. Okay, well, he's abusive when he's drunk. So I can stay with him if he's not abusive, or her, and that means he or she can't get drunk. So, no more alcohol. And therefore, we can have a relationship, and we don't have to deal with the abuse because we just never get drunk. But if the other person can't do that, and is abusive when drunk, it's not excusable. Being drunk is not an excuse for anything. It's a reason to do stupid things, but it's not an excuse, and it's not permissible. So, you don't date, you don't stay in relationships with people who are alcoholics or drug addicts. You won't change them. You won't cure them. You can support them if they are seeking their own cure, if they are actively engaged in a treatment program to change their behavior. It's okay to support them and be in a relationship with them. If they're not doing that, you bail, because it'll get worse. And marrying them, having children with them, will not make it better. And it'll make you worse. So you don't do it. Okay. Argument as a joint activity. Some of us love to argue. And we love to win. And that's okay. And it's okay in a relationship. Okay. To engage in the joint activity of argument. Some people do it and love it. Some of us can't stand it. Some of us get in relationships where there's one person who loves to argue and one who doesn't, and eventually you sort that out. But it's a molar activity. It's a joint molar activity. It has meaning. Whether you're arguing for the sake of arguing or arguing because you're really in it and you're really pissed off about the other person's view, and you can't respect the other person's view, and the other person is blaming you, argument is a molar activity. It's very important in a relationship when it happens. It has intent, right? We want to resolve the argument or the disagreement so we can come to agreement. And it has momentum. People will stay in it until it's resolved. People will stay up till 4 in the morning arguing. People will come back to the same argument over and over and over again. They won't leave it. They won't drop it. Bulldogs. We're all bulldogs at heart in argument. So we come back to it. We stay in it. Can it get more complex? Sure. Simple disagreement escalates into violence. I don't think that's a good idea for you to do that. Ends up with somebody getting hurt. People become manipulative. People learn to have arguments in which they can put the other person down and win in a relationship. People learn to direct the arguments in ways that put the other person at a disadvantage, so the other person eventually stops arguing and caves in. People make their arguments so complex that the other person can't keep up with them. People make kitchen sink arguments. You have a disagreement about how long to cook the cookies. Right? I picked that one randomly. How long do you bake the cookies? Is it 8 minutes or is it 10 minutes? Do you like them soft? Do you like them crunchy? People will kill each other over all kinds of interesting things. That's one. Because the argument escalates. And it goes from, should it be 8 minutes to 10 minutes, to you don't know anything about cooking, to neither do you, and you can fill in the script so that it becomes, you're also not very good in bed, and that reminds me that you've had 3 affairs in the last 4 years, and I don't know why I put up with you. And you're a lousy parent, too. And we went from cookies to the kitchen sink and everything else that will fit in it as part of the argument, and people forget what they were arguing about, which is how long to bake cookies. You resolve that argument by deciding what the impact of the extra 2 minutes is going to be and how you like your cookies, and maybe compromising on 9 minutes. Or how about we do one cookie sheet with 8 minutes, which will be soft like I like them, and the other one at 10 minutes, so they'll be a little crunchier like you like them, and then we'll both be amazingly happy. You have to be a complex thinker to come up with that. Right. It helps. When arguments get to be very complex and very negative, then the question is, can we make the argument more complex, more interesting, more positive, more reciprocal, and more equally balanced? Can you argue in a way, can you disagree in a way, can you discuss conflicts and differing viewpoints in ways that enhance the relationship? Sure you can. Sure you can. And that brings us back to looking at the transaction, trying to understand your own view and the other person's view and seeing how you put those together in a transaction. You can, at the beginning of a relationship, agree to argue in ways that will enhance the relationship. Which means that you will resist calling each other names, you will stick to the topic of the disagreement, you will not bring in outside authority or information that is unrelated to the point of disagreement. You will listen to the other person respectfully. You have a commitment in a disagreement or in an argument to understand the other person's viewpoint thoroughly. You have to put yourself in the other person's shoes. And you can agree to do that. So that, at the beginning of a relationship, you say, this is how we will argue, and we both have the responsibility to correct each other or to call each other's attention when we're not doing it the right way. So if you start to call me names when we have a disagreement, I'm going to say, I think you just, can we come back to being nice to each other? Calling me names does not help me understand your viewpoint. Let me listen while you explain yourself until I really understand and can repeat your position and understand it. So that I really understand why you think the cookies ought to be baked for 10 minutes instead of 8. Or why the shower curtain should be left open or closed. You can establish the rules for the complex game of disagreement. And if you do that in a way that lets you actually understand the disagreement instead of hurt each other, you can resolve most disagreements. One of the more interesting ones, I mentioned the shower curtain. I have to give you an example from a couple. It was very interesting. They had a disagreement early on in their cohabitation about the shower curtain. They didn't argue about the toothpaste tubes, I understand, but they did argue about the shower. And you've got a curtain, right? And one of them made the comment that she thought the shower curtain should be left open after you take a shower. And the other person in the disagreement said that he thought the shower curtain should be closed. And that argument escalated. It didn't actually go beyond the topic. They didn't bring in anything else. But they kept repeating their positions and why their positions were better. Reducing the growth of mold, letting the shower dry out, letting air circulate. And it was a fascinating conversation to listen to because one of them ended up in tears and was quite upset. And it turned out from the objective observer's viewpoint, not involved in the argument, that they were probably both saying exactly the same thing. And they wanted the same thing. It turned out to be a semantic argument about whether the curtain should be open or closed. They both meant that it should be halfway. One of them meant by open that you pull the shower curtain out and the other person thought that it meant to close it part way. What they eventually got to was the understanding they're both talking about part way, and one was referring to the shower curtain being open this way, and if you pull it this way, the other person thought you were closing the curtain. And it took them about 45 minutes to realize that one was describing some aspect of the curtain, the other was probably describing some aspect of the opening. Okay. So one wanted the opening to be partly open, and the other one wanted the curtain to be partly closed. And but if you stop listening to each other and just keep saying the same thing over and over again and don't try to understand the other's viewpoint and don't have the skills to figure out what the other person wants or how to get the information that you need, you end up in tears. This couple did not break up. They eventually were able to laugh about it. The fascinating thing was that neither of them thought, and this is what I threw into the discussion after the fact, would you show me what you would like? It turned out to be an argument about open and close. Neither of them asked the other person to say, show me how it ought to be after a shower. And had they done that in the first step, there would have been no disagreement. Oh, gee, I call that open, you call that closed. Oh, okay. That's interesting. It would have been fun. They didn't do that. So they were lacking a basic skill of finding out what the other person wanted. In general, for an argument to be positive, for a disagreement to be positive, it has to be fair. It has to be respectful. It has to eventually be resolved in a way that the couple can feel they have actually accomplished something. And they appreciate that. Some of the literature on happy couples over the long period, people have been married 20, 30, 40 years who are happy with each other and think they have a really great partner. One of the characteristics of them, and we'll look at more, but one of the characteristics of those couples is that they have appreciated their ability to resolve differences. So they see solving a problem together as an accomplishment that is respected, that it should be celebrated, as opposed to couples who feel that if I resolve the argument by winning, that's good. That leads to negative affect. If we resolve a conflict, whether I end up on the winning or losing side, whether we end up doing what you wanted to do or what I wanted to do, if we resolve it, that's what should be celebrated, not who won or who lost, or who is more powerful in the relationship. Balance means that both people are accorded equal power. So we spend as much time listening to me as we do to you. We each have the reciprocal obligation to understand the other person's viewpoint. And typically, when we're engaging in a disagreement, we have ground rules, such as no name calling, unless you really lose it and then you have to apologize later. Such as short-circuiting the argument when things are not going well. And there are many ways to short circuit. One of my very favorite ones, the phrase from a psychologist named Dreyfus, who years ago put out a kind of curriculum for couples, and the title of it is, "Talk to me as if I were someone you love." put that in the middle of an argument when somebody is being nasty to you or disrespectful, put that comment into the middle of an argument, and it does wonderful things. If it doesn't get you shot, you know. Some people don't like to be reminded that they're acting like assholes. But other people like to be reminded that we're in a relationship, we love each other, we should talk to each other that way, so calling me names and being disrespectful is probably not going to win my affection.
I was just going to ask, what was the comment?
Talk to me as if I were someone you love. It's a good one with parents and children, too. You know, when your kid is saying, I hate you, and calling you names, you say, would you talk to me as if I were someone you love? And if you're the kid, you can do it too. Again, be out of arm's reach when you say it. There are many ways to interrupt an argument that has gotten out of hand. That's one. Another is to simply say, this argument's getting out of hand. Is this what we want to do? Can we rethink this? Or when you realize that you've lost it, stopping. Just stopping. You think, oh, wait a minute. I'm behaving in ways that I don't like. I'm being somebody that I don't want to be. So let's back up a little bit and see if I can do it the right way, the way I'd rather do it. Because you really wanted to hate him. The general technique is not to get into reciprocal blaming or being disrespectful or name calling. If you get into that, you can't resolve the argument. If one person is in it and the other person is not, then you have the possibility of calming down and coming to some kind of reasonable process. Maybe not an agreement, but you at least want the process to be reasonable. It helps if you have the skill when somebody else is getting out of hand to remain calm. It helps if you have the skill to slow down and to calm down and to back up and to become quieter and to listen, and if you do that, typically other people are likely to follow suit, and they'll calm down and they'll stop yelling at you. Or if they don't, they will suddenly realize that they're acting like idiots and that you're not engaged with them. So if you say, good. Okay. Now we can talk about why you hate me and what you'd like me to do about it. And then we're into conflict resolution. Another technique that's very useful when the others have failed or you've forgotten them and you've stalked out. I like that. People stomp out, slam doors, hopefully don't get in your car and burn rubber and get into an accident and get killed, because that keeps you from resolving the argument and makes the other person either very happy or very guilty or both. What you want to do, and this requires some skill, is after things have gotten completely out of hand and blown up, then to ask for a post-mortem, an autopsy. It's also called processing the argument, but I like calling it an autopsy. Okay, we had this thing that happened, and it was really not something we'd like to repeat. So perhaps we should figure out how it happened, what happened, and how we might avoid it in the future. and a communication autopsy or postmortem says, okay, let's rewind the tape and go back to when it started. And talk through as a couple, and sometimes this works better with a therapist, but talk through where it started and how you were both feeling and what you were both seeing so that you can come to some kind of understanding of where things began to get off the track. And if you are smart enough and skilled enough to do that, then you can come to a point in reviewing the discussion where you can say, wait a minute, that's when I began to feel really angry. And then I said whatever it was. And I think it just all fell apart from there when I said that. Okay, so what would have happened if when I felt angry because of what you were saying, that was my response to, what if I had said something different? What if instead of popping off as I did, what if I had said, well, tell me what I could have said that you would have been able to hear. What would you have wanted me to say at that point? So if you can go back and figure out how to do the argument, the same argument, differently, then you have a leg up for the next one. You figure out how the other person responded, what you did that maybe wasn't particularly helpful. And it is helpful if you have the attitude in the postmortem, in the autopsy, of maybe I didn't behave as well as I should have. Maybe I could have said things differently in a way that wouldn't have triggered whatever your nasty response was. Maybe we could have resolved this amicably if I had done something differently. If you take that approach, then you have the possibility of getting to a better understanding of what is going on in the arguments. That takes a lot of skill, it takes a lot of motivation to do that. And in the remaining minute, that's what I just said. If you have a valid view of the world and yourself and the skills, then you can initiate those discussions in your relationship, either at the beginning to set up expectations, or in the middle when things have gotten out of hand, you can establish the basic ground rules, which is we always try to treat each other respectfully. We always try to listen and understand the other person's viewpoint. And we don't argue when either of us has been drinking. There's no point in having an argument with somebody who's under the influence of alcohol or drugs. They won't remember it anyway. So there's just no point, so don't do it. Come back and argue with me when you're sober. That's fine, then we can have an argument. Or I won't argue with you because I'm drunk. So, sorry, you're probably right, I'm probably behaving badly, but I'm inebriated, so I'm going to go get sick in the bathroom by myself, and I'll clean it up later. It's not your job. Yeah, whatever it takes. You can set up ground rules that you can then call each other to account on. And you don't have to follow them all the time, but it's helpful to know that you haven't, and to apologize when you don't, in both parties. Okay, we'll go on from there and talk about relationships and cohabitation.